Well, thank you very much, and thanks to the deans for the sponsorship of this lecture series and this opportunity for me to come and visit y'all. I've enjoyed my time here, and I pray it will be a blessing to you. My training is in paleontology, study of fossils, so a fossil record has a special place in my heart. I know that seems weird. Fossils are just a bunch of dead things, so I have a special place in my heart for a cemetery. But I got to do this right here. It's technical things that mystify me. Let's try this again. There we go. In creationism, however, in young age creationism, I have a bit of a challenge ahead of me. And when it comes to paleontology, paleontology is a study of fossils. Fossils are remains, at least I believe them to be, remains of biological organisms of the past preserved in rocks. Now, in point of fact, if you're going to properly understand fossils, you really need to understand both rocks and critters and plants. You need to understand the organisms and the rocks. That means really before you can do any synthetic work in paleontology, you need a synthetic biology, some synthetic model of biology, and some synthetic model of geology. Back in 1989, when I completed my doctorate, there was no creationist model of geology or biology. And I saw the situation there as not conducive to creating a creationist paleontology. That's more or less the case, case now, although in the intervening years, we've produced a biosystematics, a method of classifying organisms, and we have introduced a geologic model I presented a little bit of yesterday, and we're about to introduce a biological model within the next year or so. We should be presenting that for the first time. These are exciting, and they mean that we might be right on the verge of being able to actually get into paleontology finally at last. That's something I hope to do. And in the meantime, I have just dabbled a little bit in paleontology as it pertains to creationism. And I developed this lecture is actually a variation on a formal lecture that I give for secular audiences. If a secular university has me come and speak on the subject of creationism, this is a subject I will bring up, since I can fairly well deal with concerns that people might have in the area of paleontology. And what I'm doing here is I am going to look at the broadest way to the fossil record. If, in fact, creationism can answer the very biggest of the questions in the fossil record, I'm convinced that it should be possible in the course of time to work out the details. So I'm going to be focusing on the major characteristics of the fossil record. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through a series of these, and basically we'll go till we run out of time. I probably have more here than the time allots, but I have them I have it compartmentalized. There's an argument one, argument two, argument three, argument four, so I'll just stop whenever we run out of time. In each case, what I'm going to do is I'm going to examine some particular aspect of the fossil record, and I'm going to compare the predictions of the conventional model. I'm going to call it that, the conventional model, which is to say that the conventional model of paleontology would involve, one, the biological model of macro or mega evolution, and two, the geological model of a very old Earth, plate tectonics, and so on and so forth. Okay, so that will be the conventional model. And I'll be comparing that with what I call in secular campuses a crazy idea. The crazy idea, and it really is crazy even to a creationist. The crazy idea is, let's say we started with an Earth filled with critters and plants just like we have today. And let's say we just picked up all the critters and plants and we threw it into a big vat of water and threw a whole bunch of sand and mud and all that stuff in and jiggled it all around and then threw it down on the ground. And take a look at it. See if that crazy idea, because of course even creationists don't believe Noah's flood was anything like that. They believe it encroached upon the land and it was systematic in its activity and so on and so forth. It's not a pick everything up and whoop into mix them all up. It's not going to work that way. If you know anything about random processes, assuming random processes held sway during the flood, randomness does not produce disorder. Randomness produces pattern. And so we're going to look at some of those. We're going to compare the conventional model with a crazy idea. Every once in a while, I'm going to modify that crazy idea to make it a little less crazy, for the purpose of the whatever we're looking at. I would suggest that the fossil record is actually the ultimate test case between creation and evolution, because very few other things reach back into the past to sample time in such a way that you can distinguish between the two. You examine modern biology, and you're examining the effects of history, but it's hard to interpret what is history from what was original and from what is actually the result of recent processes. The fossil record, however, supposedly documents change through time. And you ought to be able to compare the two models most dramatically like that. Let's first consider the issue of how would you expect fossils to change up section, up the stratigraphic column. First of all, in conventional theory, you might expect that if you have critter A and critter B, and critter A and critter B are sitting in the, first of all, biologically, you'd expect critter A evolving into critter B, and it's going to do so through a series of intermediates. This is an intuitive understanding of evolution. Thus, if you have A and B in the fossil record, you would expect between the two of them, you ought to have a series of intermediates between them. And so you would expect, more or less, intuitively, you would expect continuous change between two organisms. Now, if you have a third organism, C, you might actually get a situation. Evolution also allows branching, not just continuous change between organisms, but in fact branching to produce two organisms from one. And there in the fossil record, once again, you would expect, in this case, divergence of two organisms from each other. So the fossil record, one would think intuitively, should be documenting a situation of continuous change between species and then divergence between two different organisms. Now contrast that with the crazy idea. You just dump everything in the fossil record, and what would you expect? If you had species A, B, and C, given that this crazy idea was that we have A, B, and C living on the Earth, and we pick up examples, a bunch of examples of A, a bunch of examples of B, a bunch of examples of C, and then just toss them in the fossil record, well, what you'd expect to find is every time you find A, you're going to find A. And you're not going, there's just going to be A, 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 because they're all sampled from the same population. Likewise with B, you're just going to find B, 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 and C, 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 C. So you might expect that in the fossil record, you're going to see unchanging examples of species. You're going to find the first time the species exists, the last time the species exists, you're going to find continuity in morphology. Basically, you're going to expect stasis. An organism will not change through the fossil record, and what Steve Gould calls abrupt appearance. Now, that's a funny concept, because how does a fossil non-abruptly appear? Cheshire cat, you know, just kind of half of the fossil appear or something. I don't know what, maybe fuzzy. Maybe it's fuzzy when it first comes in, but that's not what he means. What he means is that there's no gradation up to that taxon. When you first see it, it is fully that organism, and there isn't continuous change leading to it from another organism. And there is not divergence between or from some ancestral organism to some resultant organism. Now, I have to add here that this is not just at the level of species that we would expect this. We would expect this at every taxonomic level. Whether species or genus or family or class, you'd expect it at every single level. Likewise, in conventional theory, you would expect this continuous change and divergence to be occurring at every taxonomic level, species all the way up to phyla and kingdoms. In contrast, the creation, the flood theory would suggest abrupt appearance and stasis at every taxonomic level. What's the observation in the fossil record? Well, you probably already know because it's oft reported. The fossil record does in fact show stasis and abrupt appearance. Stunningly enough, species, when they appear in the fossil record, appear with that particular morphology when they first arrive, and when they're last found in the fossil record, they still have that morphology. For my thesis, I worked on, among other things, some brachiopods, some lingulid brachiopods. That's if there's something that's boring to work on, that ranks among one of the most boring. Because, in fact, throughout the entire Pennsylvanian, Mississippian, what the Europeans call Carboniferous section of the geologic column, there are species that remain unchanged. Lingula middleoides, for example. When you first find Lingula middleoides, it is identifiable as such. When you last find it, it's still Lingula middleoides, no difference through, in conventional dating, 100 million years of time. A species remained completely unchanged for 100 million years of time. Now, the interesting thing is that if you look at the range of Lingula middleoides, it starts right at the base of the Carboniferous and ends right at the top of the Carboniferous. It's, you know, it's like he's out of the starting gate, and boom, he's gone. Now, if you ignore the names for a moment, and in fact look for Lingula middleoides and be blind to the rocks therein, Lingula middleoides morphology is found in the Permian. The reason it's given a different name is because it couldn't possibly be that a species existed for more than 100 million years unchanged. The exact morphology is found in the Carboniferous is found 100 million years earlier, and in the Permian 100 million years later. Lingula middleoides, this wonderful little cat called a brach, is actually 300 million years long without any morphological change. This is rather, the average species duration of an invertebrate in the fossil record is 30 million years by conventional dating without change. There are no good species transitions, no continuous change from one organism to another documented for any invertebrate, for any vertebrate. There are some possibilities in some micro in micropaleo, some of the foraminifera, little one-celled organisms in the ocean, seem to have some evidence of possibly some species transitions, but actually the only difference between the ancestor and the descendant is size. So actually you have continuous size change. You have abrupt appearance and stasis for all species. Thus, Steve Gould and Niles Eldridge introduced punctuated equilibrium theory to account for that. The problem is, it's not just true at species level. It's true at the genus level, at the family level, at the order level, at the class level, at the phylum level, and at the kingdom level. In the Cambrian, for example, animal phyla come in what's called the Cambrian explosion with no apparent transition from any preceding organisms. Punctuated equilibrium explains, perhaps, the transition from one species to another, stasis and abrupt appearance at the level of species. But it does not, it cannot, and it can never explain the transition above the level of species. It's genera, families, classes, orders, so on. So right now, Steve Gould, for example, is frustrated with the fact that there is no evolutionary mechanism to explain stasis and abrupt appearance above the level of species. So what we have is the fossil record, is more consistent, at least on this level, with this crazy idea of the flood. Second, completeness of the fossil of the species record. Now, what I'm asking here is, what percentage of all the species which have ever lived on the history of this, in the history of this earth, are preserved as fossils? That's the completeness of species. How many species have we recorded? According to conventional theory, we have, in general, I'm going to have to explain this, I guess. The stratigraphic column, the geologic record stacked from the oldest to the youngest, dated conventionally at 600 million to zero to the present, there is a diversity curve through that period of time. This is the total number of taxa, let's say the number of families that exist in the Cambrian, in the Ordovician, in the Silurian, in the Devonian. So this is a picture of how many different families there are. This is actually the family curve. The genus curve, how many genera are extant at a given time, is very, very similar to this, a little bumpier, but for the most part following the same kind of curve. Likewise, the orders are a little less bumpy, a little smoother, but following very much the same curve. So what can do from this is we can estimate how many organisms lived through all time. And this is basically how you would do that. If you had number of species versus geologic time, let's say you had two species, each of which existed for 600 million years, species A and species B. Now, how many species existed in geologic time then? Two. Okay. So we're wanting to get two. And the way you can do that is, in fact, take the area under the curve, which is the height, the height here, which is 2, multiply it by 600 million years, and you get 1,200 million years times species. The average species duration is 600 million years. Each of these species exists as a species for 600 million years. When you divide the area under the curve by the average species duration, you get two species. This is the principle that you use on the actual diversity curve. So what you do is you take the integral under the curve, the area under the curve, and divide by the average species duration, for example, 30 million years for invertebrates, which, by the way, is always an underestimate because we're not getting the beginnings and ends of the ranges, but that's a detail. When you do that, you find that the total number of species which have ever lived on the surface of this earth is, according to conventional theory, greater than 50 billion. Greater than 50,000 million species have existed on the surface of this earth. So perhaps you've heard the claim that far less than 1% of all the species that have ever lived have been found in the fossil record, and that's where this comes from. Since we know we've actually classified, named about 250,000 fossil species, you can take the number of fossil species known, divide it by 50,000 million, which is the number of species we believe to have existed on the surface of the Earth, and we conclude that far, far less than 1% of all the species that have ever lived on the surface of this Earth have been preserved as fossils. Okay, got that? According to conventional theory, the fossil record is terribly, terribly incomplete when it comes to preserving species. In spite of the fact that they've been around for 30 million years to get sampled, we've actually only sampled far less than 1 in 100. In fact, it's more like 1 in 10,000. Now, what about that crazy flood theory idea? Well, if in fact you took all the organisms on Earth, piled them all up in one place, dumped them in the fossil record, or dumped them in a pile of sediment very quickly, there's not an awful lot of time for decomposition. You're going to preserve most everything that's there. Now, so the very simplest, this craziest idea would predict about 100% species preservability. Now, if you use a little more reasonable idea of the flood, that in fact it took a little bit of time, like a couple months maybe, to accomplish its task of burying everything, you're going to lose a lot of the soft-bodied critters and so on and so forth. So you can estimate at least soft-bodied organisms maybe as low as 30%, but you're still talking about when you compare that with conventional theory, a very big difference. The two theories predict something very different about the total species preservability of the fossil record. The flood model should have a much higher percentage of species that ever lived preserved in the fossil record. Well, how in the world do you test this? Well, there's a kind of a cute little way to do it. Let's try what we can do is look at modern species and find out how many modern species have a fossil record. Well, there's a way to test how complete the fossil record is. Modern species, if far less than 1% of the fossil of modern species have a fossil record, then it's reasonable to say that fits conventional theory if it's higher otherwise. Well, what do you actually find? Well, actually, Curtain back in 1967 did this for the first one to actually try this. He looked at mammals in Europe, and he found that 88% of the species of mammals in Europe had a fossil record in Europe. Of the other 12%, 11 of those 12% had a fossil record somewhere. Only 99% of the mammals in Europe have a fossil record. That's 99% preservability. Other people have done this in mammals in different places on the earth, like Australia and so on and so forth, and gotten lower levels, as low as 30%. But that's changing now, by the way. They're finding more and more fossils in Australia, and they've actually got a much higher percentage now for mammals. Also, Jim Valentine did a PhD dissertation in Baja California and Southern California on the beaches there. I'm not sure why he chose such a terrible place to do a dissertation, but you know, he was studying mollusks in those two locations, and he was looking at modern species of mollusk, clams and gastropods, snails. Clams and snails, and comparing the modern species with the fossil ones, and found that typically 75 to 80% of those groups were known as fossils. And we've found that consistently wherever we've looked. So what we actually find is a fossil record seems to be very good at preserving organisms. It's not far, far less than 1% of all species that have ever lived. It's up in the range predicted in the crazy idea. Another issue, number three, stratomorphic intermediates. If you haven't ever heard of this word, it's because I created it, so it's okay if you don't know it. Stratomorphic. Strata is a stratum is a layer of rock. Strata is the plural of that, more than one layer of rock. Morph is the shape. The morphology of an organism would be a description of the organism, if you wish. A stratigraphic intermediate is an organism that's sitting stratigraphically in the fossil record between two other organisms. It's stratigraphically intermediate. A morphological intermediate is one that's morphologically between two other organisms. It looks like it's half one thing and half another. Like a platypus kind of looks like a strange mixture between a mammal and a bird. And that's what, of course, the first the people at the British Museum thought when they received the first specimen of a platypus. They thought somebody had played a trick on them by sewing a bill on a mammal. And if they had heard that the thing laid eggs, they would have really gone crazy on that. That's a morphological intermediate. A stratomorphic intermediate would be an organism that's stratigraphically between two other organisms and simultaneously biologically between two organisms. Now, if you're an evolutionist in conventional theory, you would want that sort of thing. You'd expect that organisms change through time. You'd expect stratomorphic intermediates. Some people call these things transitional forms, but I don't like that term because that's an interpretive term. You're interpreting it evolutionarily. I'd prefer to call it descriptively a stratomorphic intermediate. Evolution would predict that stratomorphic intermediate, intuitively you might expect them to be very common, that all groups of organisms should have lots of stratomorphic intermediates in the fossil record. Now it turns out that depending on how you think preservability is in the fossil record and so on, some people will argue they can be rare, but intuitively, you would expect actually many stratimorphic intermediates in the fossil record. What about the crazy idea? Would you expect stratimorphic intermediates in the crazy idea? Now, most people would shake their head and say, no. Actually, I do predict some, extremely rare, and here I'll explain why. Question for you, audience participation. What evolved from what? Help me out. Suggestions. Spoon into a pot. How did I know you're going to do that? Okay, what's another possibility? Oh, pot to the spoon. Could be. Actually, there's another possibility here too, which is that the whatever that frying pan or whatever it is in between evolved into the other two. And of course, you're all wrong because they're specially created. They didn't evolve. No, I'm sorry. Just had to do that. Well, I always had a fun time at Harvard. I'll have to put this in just for fun. When we got to teaching students in paleontology about phylogeny, which is to say about trying to determine what an evolutionary history of a group was, I enjoyed greatly the means by which we did this. We took macaroni. We went to the store and bought macaroni. Now, before this, I was macaroni ignorant. I had no idea there were as many types of macaroni as there are. Wow! Not only are they all sorts of different shapes and sizes and so on, but they're also different. They've got spinach macaroni. They've got tomato macaroni. So they're different colors too. This is cool. I mean, you can get all sorts of different kinds of macaroni. We put them into one bin, mix them all up. We take a handful of these things and dump them out in front of each student. And we'd say, now, your first assignment is to arrange these things in an evolutionary order. Okay? So they'd all work. And they'd put these things in an evolutionary order. I would be laughing at this point. But anyway, they'd be producing an evolutionary tree, and then we would have them do a taxonomic key and all sorts of fun things with these things. And usually after, and I taught 16 semesters at Harvard, so did this a number of times, and about 25% of my class typically was even young age creationist at Harvard. It's kind of interesting. Yet never did I ever have a student say, can't do this. Every student I gave this to did it. Sheep. They're sheep. and the first thing I would say, because I thought this was hilarious, first thing I would say was, they're specially created. You just put specially created things into an evolutionary order. Does that tell you something? Maybe other people are doing that with fossils and things. Maybe they really aren't. Maybe they didn't really, it's really interesting. But here we go. So we can produce an evolutionary order for anything. And interestingly enough, we have a problem here that is evident in these spoons and pans and things. You can't what we call root a tree. You don't know whether it went from one end or the other end or somewhere in the middle. Unless you have some a priori reason to believe that this group evolved from something else, you don't know which way it went. There's no polarity to the phylogeny. Now, what that means is it has this consequence. Somebody give me some organism. And don't be boring, cat or dog or something. Give me an organism. Squid, good, I love it. Okay, squid. Take this group of people in this room. Among you, there is one of you which is more squid-like than everyone else in the room. Don't look around now, that's not nice. if you look at certain characteristics of a squid, there will be one person in the room who is more squid-like than everyone else. If you take a second characteristic of a squid, there will be someone else in the room more squid-like than everyone else. So if you presume that this group evolved from a squid, and you took this group of people and arranged it in an evolutionary sequence, you could suggest that one of you in here is the ancestor of all of the rest. So if I took all of you and threw you into the fossil record, such as I described in that crazy theory, however many people here under one divided by the number of people here, is the chances that that person, which is most squid-like, might actually end up the oldest individual in the fossil record. And since there's more than one of you, there are more than one of you that are more squid-like than others in different aspects, it's actually the number of squid-like characteristics times one over the number of people in here gives you the probability that in doing this once, you would expect to get a stratimorphic intermediate at the very beginning of your fossil record. At the same time, realizing that in the fossil record, what we're doing is actually doing this for hundreds of groups. You've essentially done this hundreds of times. You would expect that every once in a blue moon, so to speak, a couple of them happened this year, right? That in fact you would get stratimorphic intermediates. So you'd expect them to be extremely rare, but just probabilistically you would expect occasionally stratimorphic intermediates. What do you find? Is it rare to common or is it extremely rare? In fact, what's interesting is that there are no stratimorphic intermediates reported for any of the invertebrates. A vast percentage of all the organisms on the surface of the earth, of course, animals, are invertebrates. There are no stratimorphic intermediates claimed for the invertebrates. In literally scores and scores of groups, no stratimorphic intermediates. You never hear about the transitional form to a squid. You never hear about the transitional form to a brachiopod. But 99% of the fossil record is shallow marine invertebrates. Most of the fossil record is that. And we have no transitional forms there. The only claims for transitional forms, for stratimorphic intermediates, are in the mammal-like reptiles, the birds, the whales. That's it. Just three groups out of hundreds in the fossil record. And this is intriguing. It seems to fit this crazy idea better than the conventional idea. Another issue, order of first appearance. When, in what sequence, do fossils come into the fossil record? You might expect that in conventional theory, they should appear in evolutionary branching order. The things that evolve first should come first, the things that evolve second should come second, and so on. It's kind of intuitively obvious. In a flood theory, what would you expect? Randomness for this crazy idea. However, if the flood is not this crazy kind of thing, and it actually moves from, it's like a flood, it moves from the sea to the land, you might expect that you're going to bury sea communities before terrestrial communities, that there might be a tendency for you to actually, a second order effect might actually be a sea to land transition. But your first order, you would expect randomness. What do you actually find? This is not easy to determine, by the way. What you have to do is you have to, first of all, produce a tree of relationship among organisms. So, for example, here you have the bacteria, the archaebacteria and the eubacteria, and you have to produce a tree of relationship for these things based only on biology, not on where they're found in the fossil record, of course. And then coming off of this, this isn't the whole diagram. Of course, you got the eukaryotes down here, and here they continue. And here are the eukaryote protoctistans, the algae and the protist kingdoms and classes. I'm only looking at classes, phyla, and kingdoms. So I'm ignoring everything. I'm just looking at the first order of the major groups at this point, partly because the size of the tree is enormous as it is. So you have the fungi, and you have the algae and the protists. So coming off of this, you have more. You have the plants, plant phyla in classes, and you also have the animals, the animal phyla and classes. So once you've now produced trees for basically a huge evolutionary tree for life, then what you do is you can now determine that the entoprox should come into the fossil record after the acanthocephalans and so on and so on. So you get a rank order prediction of when each of these are going to come into the record, and you can compare that with the actual order that you find in the record. Here's a partial, this is a partial list of those, where each entry, each triad entry here is a sequence of organisms, and the R here is a rank correlation coefficient. That is, if it's a positive number, it means that the order in the fossil record is in the same direction as the order predicted by the evolutionary tree. If it's a 1, that means it's in perfect evolutionary order. If it's 0, it's completely random with respect to evolution. If it's a negative number, it means it's going in the opposite direction as evolution would predict. And if it's a negative 1, it's exactly opposite to what evolution predicts. In the third column is the necessary correlation coefficient to reach or to exceed in order to reject the null hypothesis of randomness. But just looking down the center column, you can see that about 50% of the time you have negative numbers. About 50% of the time, the fossil record is going in the opposite direction as is predicted by evolutionary theory. And in fact, when you do this, you find that 95% of the sequences of the first appearance of classes, phyla, and kingdoms are random with respect, in other words, you can't reject the null hypothesis of randomness with respect to evolution. 95% of the first appearances of major group come into the record randomly with respect to evolution. There's only the 5%, now at a 5% confidence interval, you say, forget it, there's no more consideration needed. But the 5% that are left are kind of interesting, because the 5% left are the ones you hear about. The vertebrates, for example, just barely qualify. The going from the fish to the amphibians to the reptiles to the mammals to the and birds, that fits just barely. You reject the null hypothesis of randomness. Another example are the arthropods going from the trilobites to things like the squid, shrimp and that sort of thing, to insects. And then the group that really is in just almost a perfect evolutionary order are the plants. The plant phyla and classes are just beautiful. They land right in the proper order. There are only three groups that are in that kind of order at a higher level. The only three that correspond to evolution. It's interesting, those three, the plants are thought to have evolved from algae in the ocean, and they evolved to land plants. The arthropods are thought to have evolved from trilobites in the ocean to insects on the land. The vertebrates are thought to evolve from fish in the sea to the vertebrates on the land. There are only three sequences that evolution predicts went from the sea to the land. And those are the only three that fit evolutionary order. So 95% of the fossil record is coming in randomly with respect to evolution, but the 5% that remains is actually a sea to land transition. And if you just ignored evolution but just rank filed these organisms on the basis of their ecology as to whether they're in ocean versus land, you explain far more of the first appearance of major groups in the fossil record than you do by evolution. So actually, this crazy idea of a flood explains more of the first appearance in the fossil record than does evolutionary theory. I probably should pay some attention to the time, shouldn't I? What have I got? Okay. yeah, we might actually make it. Okay, another fun topic. Let's say you wanted to become a fossil. Now some of you already are. Let's say you wanted to become, you had some crazy, I mean, this really would be crazy aspiration to be a fossil in some drawer in some museum someplace. What kind of thing must one go through to do this? Of course, the first thing you have to do to become a fossil is you have to avoid the carnivores in your environment. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to focus on the marine realm, as if you live in the marine realm, because, in fact, 95% of all the fossils are from the shallow marine invertebrate record, and so we're going to assume you're a marine invertebrate. That increases your probability of getting into the museum cabinet. But the first thing you have to do is you have to avoid the carnivores, because they tend to crunch you up and spit you out in little pieces, and it doesn't make very good fossils. So the first thing you do is you run away from the carnivores. You might be able to do that, but you have another problem. Once you die, you now got to deal with the scavengers who are running along the bottom and so on and so forth, eating and munching and, again, spitting you out into little pieces, and you're not going to get into the fossil record. And it's kind of hard to run from a scavenger, given that you're dead. So this is a significant challenge. One way, perhaps, that you can do this is to get buried. Maybe that will help, because the scavengers then can't find you. But then you have another problem. You have the aerobic decomposers. You have the little critters who are in the soil at the bottom of the ocean, in the mud at the bottom of the ocean. They're running around in there, and they're eating and munching away on dead organisms already buried. Now, these are aerobic decomposers. They require oxygen to breathe, so they typically, you know, dig down little burrows and so on in order to get that oxygen. So getting buried gets you out of the scavengers, but it doesn't get you away from the aerobic decomposers. And again, you have a little bit of trouble running away, given that you're not only dead, you're also buried. And so maybe perhaps it would be better for you if you got buried deeply below the oxic zone, below the place where oxygen can reach. But you still have a problem because now you have anaerobic decomposers, bacteria and that sort of thing that don't need oxygen, and they munch away on you after you are dead and buried and out of the aerobic zone. And if that wasn't bad enough, of course, you have subsequent erosion after you have even become a fossil. Let's say you've gotten to that stage. You've got to be brought back up to the surface so you can be found as a fossil. That means everything's got to be eroded above you, but of course that means you are at risk of getting eroded in the process. Or, you make it to the surface and a cow comes by and crushes you. You know, you have to be found by a paleontologist rather than a collector, of course, or a little kid. Ooh, cool! Whew. Yeah, a skipping stone and. In order to end up in the museum drawer. It's kind of a difficult thing to become a fossil. In fact, the probability of preservation is basically low on a normal Earth. And so in conventional theory, we're usually talking about slow deposition. On the average, you have extremely slow deposition. That means the probability of preservation should be extremely low. It's going to be awfully tough to get preserved as a fossil under these conditions. In contrast, this crazy idea of rapid deposition at great depths, a mile and a half of debris over the continental surface, is an awfully good way to increase your chances of becoming a fossil. If we're talking about rapid deep deposition, we might expect common, well-preserved fossils. And what, in fact, do we find? In fact, on this very campus, you find some of this. The pillars to your library, for example, are cut from what looks like the St. Louis limestone. And if you look closely at those pillars, you probably shouldn't do it when other people are looking. They look at me very strangely when I do this too. But if you look very closely at those pillars, you'll find that they are actually made of millions of fossils. And, for example, if you walk over the, it's symbolic only, but the foundation stones of most of the buildings on campus have the year of that particular building cut into a cross-bedded bioclastite of the Mississippian system, which is to say, cut into a bunch of fossils. It's just solid fossils, and extremely well preserved. If you go on the, actually I don't know directions around here, but I'm lost at this particular moment. But in one corner of the campus at the where the, is it the Women's College used to be? Boyce College used to, okay, you go down that sidewalk and you go past the place with the wonderful equisetum there, the horsetails sitting in the low area. There's a rock over there off to the side. That rock's got some beautiful fossils in it. Okay, it's just a bioclastite. It's just packed full of fossils. In the old the keystones on the above your windows. And the capstones on the walls, not the fake ones. The fake walls have concrete. You can tell the walls they put in for low cost from the walls that they use. There's an interesting history around here. I had a lot of fun inferring the architectural history of the place on the basis of this. Steps, the old steps, the expensive steps are actually made out of fossils. The newer ones are made out of concrete. But anyway, what we find in the fossil record as a rule is that fossils are extremely common and extremely well preserved in many instances. It seems intuitively that the abundance and the quality of preservation of these fossils exceeds what you would expect in conventional theory. They seem to be a bit too common to be explained by conventional modes of deposition burial. Another issue, bioturbation. It's not a nasty word. It kind of sounds like it might be, but bio is living or life. Turbulence. It's bioturbation is where living organisms mess up the environment. Okay, cause turbulence in the environment. And specifically, I am referring to messing up bottom sediments on the ocean. Again, shallow marine invertebrates focusing on that. If you have little critters that are burrowing their way into the sediment, they tend to destroy any layering lamination in those sediments. Pretty spectacular the degree to which organisms do this. Last week was the Geological Society of America annual meeting, 1999, and every GSA meeting, every meeting, every year there's a GSA meeting, and I like going to the hurricane talks. I call them the hurricane talks. Because what happens is there's some biologist somewhere has chosen his or her perfect beach, and they are going to study critters just offshore by snorkeling and so on, and study a bottom community. You know, I mean, graduate students are clever. They realize, what do you want to study? Well, actually, I want to study Aruba. So, what do we have on Aruba? Let's see. We have critters that are living offshore. We have critters living onshore. Steve Gould, for example, wanted to study Bahamas. So he studied a land snail that hangs around literally on the bushes along the shores of all the Bahama Islands. So he's got to visit them all, you know. So you've got some biologist who has chosen to study some community offshore of his or her favorite beach. And of course, you know, you're talking about a PhD dissertation, 3-year study. Well, about a year into this person's research, here comes Hurricane Hecuba. Takes all the sand off the beach, dumps it on top of that study area, destroys the entire community. And very sadly, the student goes out there, looks down at their research area, blown away. Okay, at this point you have a choice. You're a clever graduate student. You have a choice. You can find another desirable beach and start all over again, or you can be clever and say, I change my dissertation to the recovery of a biological system in the wake of an ecological catastrophe such as a hurricane. And there are a lot of these, and then of course they give talks on this, and there are always a bunch of hurricane talks at the GSA. Some poor biologist who has gotten their study area blown away. So now it becomes a geological, biological kind of thesis, modified a bit. And they're wonderful things to watch. And in every case, it's extremely interesting. Usually when you're out at 10-meter depth in water, the hurricane will dump about 3 feet of sand on top of that community. Within 1 year, in every case that I've listened to these, and I've listened to several score such talks over the years, in every case, 1 year later, you can't even recognize the 3 foot deep sand layer from the hurricane. Critters have gone in there, rehabitated the surface, dug down through the three foot material into the mud beneath, and homogenized everything. You can't even preserve 1 year later a 3 foot thick sand layer. It's unrecognizable. Bioturbation is an extraordinary phenomenon in the marine realm. It would seem to destroy all sedimentation, all lamination, if it was there. So you have a sort of a choice here. You can have bioturbated sediments, sediments that are all muffed up, and laminated sediments, those with these layers. Now, in bioturbated sediments, you would expect that what this means is there must be burrowers. If you see a bioturbated sediment, it must mean, ooh, there's a burrower around. And also that there's enough time for burrowing. In contrast, the laminated sediments would suggest that there are either no burrowers, or if there are burrowers, that there isn't enough time for them to do their burrowing. Kind of a reasonable sort of assumption there. So in bioturbation and conventional theory, given that for the most part, well, the burrowers evolved back in the Cambrian, so they've been there all along, and usually there's plenty of time for burrowing in conventional theory. You would expect then conventional theory would expect bioturbated sediments predominate. In this crazy idea, however, even if you had the critters, and they're there, but even if you had the little burrowers, there's only seconds, perhaps not even that, before you get buried, so you're not going to be able to mess up the sediment fast enough. There's not enough time for burrowing, so you would expect a predominance of laminated sediments. So again, we have a comparative prediction of the two theories. We would expect bioturbated sediments in conventional theory, laminated sediments in flood theory, and what you find predominantly are laminated sediments. In fact, I haven't looked at a lot of rocks. I've probably only looked at 400 or 500 different locations where you got piles of rocks. And so my experience is somewhat limited. But at this point, there's only one rock I know of that is so bioturbated that it's destroyed all the lamination. And it's immediately above another rock that's heavily laminated and immediately below one that's again laminated. There's another one in the Grand Canyon which is laminated to a great extent, but you can still preserve much of the layering. If you walk, you drive down the highway and you see places with the rocks and you see the layers, those layers, I mean, the lamination predominates in the fossil record. It would appear as if it suggests that there are no burrowers there, but preserved in those rocks are fossils of burrowers, the little guys that didn't make it out fast enough. So in these areas, and I guess I didn't keep track of how many there were. There's something on the order of 10 of them. I've still got more, actually. Yeah, that's right, there's another one. In evolution, you have organisms evolving on an evolutionary tree, either gradually or by punctuate equilibrium in quick steps. One way or another, you have the phenomenon that in order to get great disparity or difference between one species and another, you're going to have to go through a lot of evolutionary steps. If you want to get something, two things as different as bacteria and humans or oak trees and humans, you're going to have to do an awful lot of steps to get there. To get great disparity, which is a measure of difference among organisms, you're going to have many, many steps, and in the process, you're going to produce an enormous amount of what's called diversity. In order to get there, you've got to create thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of species. So in general, in conventional theory, your diversity, the number of species, must increase in order before you get disparity, before you get big differences among organisms. So in the disparity-diversity issue, conventional theory would predict that high diversity should precede high disparity in the fossil record. In the flood theory, on the other hand, in the simplest flood theory, you're going to pick up everything and dump it in there. You're going to get complete disparity at the very bottom. You're going to get the whole range of things at the very bottom. And you're going to get a pretty high diversity as well. In a more complicated flood model where it comes up and picks off one community at a time, each community has wide disparity but relatively low diversity compared to the diversity of the entire world. So you would expect in general in the flood theory, low diversity should come in at the same time you have high disparity. You would predict high disparity in a flood model. What do you find? The observation is that low diversity comes in spectacularly with extremely high disparity. Take, for example, the Cambrian explosion. In the Cambrian explosion in the fossil record, you've got the appearance of 40% of the animal phyla, bang, right at one level, extremely wide disparity of organisms, 40% of the animal phyla, so we're talking 12 animal phyla come in there all of a sudden. In fact, in the Burgess Shale, which is a beautifully preserved fossil unit where you get soft-bodied organisms preserved, there are 21 higher taxa in there represented, I'm sorry, 20 higher taxa, in other words, orders or above, represented in there by 21 species. 21 species with 20 higher taxa. Every species is a different higher taxon. This is extremely low diversity with extremely high disparity. The Archean explosion. Earlier in the fossil record, you find bacteria. When you find the first bacteria, you just don't find one type of bacteria. You find five different phyla of bacteria. In fact, you find the five highest evolved bacteria types all coming in the fossil record, bang, at the same time. When the echinoderms come in, things that are kind of like starfish and that sort of thing, when they come into the fossil record, there are only five modern classes of echinoderms, but in the fossil record there are 20 of them. All 20 come into the fossil record at the very first time you find an echinoderm, with a diversity that's only slightly larger than that. Typically, you get entire communities come into the fossil record with no precedent. So you've got very low diversity coming in with high disparity, which fits only the flood model, in my opinion. Conventional theory on complexity. Because of the difficulty of evolving complexity, you might expect that complexity will be rather conservative in the fossil record, and perhaps that complexity would increase up through the fossil record as evolution increases the general complexity. On the other hand, if you've already started with an Earth that has a complex ecosystem with complex organisms, you might expect complexity to predominate throughout the entire record. In fact, if you believe that that bunch of organisms was created by a wise creator, you might expect extremely high complexity. And the observation is, this is getting boring, isn't it, that you get extremely high complexity in the fossil record. One of my favorite critters is the trilobite. The trilobite comes in at the Cambrian. The first time that you find the animal phyla, you've got trilobites. In fact, that's how you define the beginning of the Cambrian, is with trilobites. And trilobites lots of people who collect fossils like trilobites because they're kind of hard to find. When you find them, they break apart very easily into little pieces because their shells are actually made of many little pieces. So In order to find a whole trilobite, that means you have to have got a critter that was actually alive at the time he was buried, and he didn't decompose at all. And they can be found, but you have to be in the right place at the right time. And trilobites, when they first come in, they're arthropods. They have many feet. They've got gills on their feet, coming off their feet. They have antennae, presumably with chemoreception capabilities. We have actually fossils that are good enough for us to X-ray them and see their internal organs and things. That's pretty cool. And you can see there's a brain in there. Eyes, extremely interesting eyes. There are a couple of groups of trilobites, as a matter of fact, that I might have. No, I didn't preserve that one. There are a couple of groups of trilobites that actually have. They have compound eyes with lenses on each individual lens that is made of calcite. Now, there's a problem when you make lenses out of hard stuff. Our lenses of our eyes are made of soft stuff, so you've got muscles that can actually adjust the shape of the lens to focus when you've got a problem with focusing. That's how you focus. When you've got a hard lens, you can't adjust the focus. And also, if you've got a nice thick lens, which they do, you've got a problem with something called spherical aberration. Anything coming in from the outside of the lens, away from the main axis, it's supposed to be focused into one point to be sharp, but a hard lens on the outside edges will never focus to a sharp point. So you get a nice clear center image, but at the edge it gets fuzzy. That's called a spherical aberration problem in physics. Back in the 17th century, two physicists independently discovered a way to create hard lenses to correct for spherical aberration. Descartes produced one theory, and it involves taking two lenses, creating a particular geometry on the lenses, putting the two lenses together into one lens, and it corrects for spherical aberration. Huygens produced a different way, and it was basically the same sort of idea, but it was a different geometric shape. And after Descartes and Huygens produced their solutions to the spherical aberration problem, no one has produced any other solutions. Those are the only two solutions known to the spherical aberration problem. And it was interesting, one of my professors at the University of Chicago was a physicist. He's building the world's first proton microscope. And he just loves collecting trilobites ever since he was a kid in Italy. So he went to paleontology symposia and went to professional paleontology meetings. That's a yawner. And he would sit in on those trilobite talks. And here's a guy speaking about some of these Cambrian trilobites, and he showed some cross sections of the eyes of these trilobites, and he said, "This is weird. These lenses, which are made of calcite, appear to be two lenses put together along a particular geometric shape. And in fact, there's a different group of trilobites that does the same thing, but a different geometric shape." Well, Riccardo Levisetti, the physicist sitting in the audience, his eyes bugged out at this. He ran up to the guy afterwards and he said, "Hey, I know what that is. Those trilobites are correcting for spherical aberration and there are two groups of trilobites that do it. One group uses Descartes' solution. One group uses Huygens' solution to correct for spherical aberration." Now, this is crazy, folks. They have a compound eye. You don't need clarity in a compound eye. Flies can't see anything clearly. What they have is a bunch of separate lenses looking out in slightly different directions, and they create each one is a pixel. They don't need clarity within each lens. They create a television screen kind of image, putting all the pixels together. And they're extremely capable of picking up slightest movement, because as soon as you move just a little bit out here, you've already come within the next eye facets vision. So the reason that it's hard to sneak up on a fly is partly because he's looking at all directions. Of course, he's got facets reaching everywhere. But also, as soon as you just barely get into the next facet, his brain picks it up immediately. So compound eyes are the best eyes in the world to pick up motion. But it doesn't matter if you can see clearly. At least that's what you would think. Simple eyes require you to see clearly. But these trilobites have compound eyes, so they have the best eyes for picking up movement. And these eyes are incredible. They start at the back of the head and they wrap all the way around to the bottom side of the thing. These trilobites can see 360 degrees, if they're swimming in the water, 360 degrees underneath them, on top of them. They have 350 degrees vision forwards and backwards. There's just a 10-degree zone back here where someone might be able to sneak up on them. That's it. And they have compound eyes, so they have the ability to pick up motion quickly. And each lens corrects for spherical aberration. Each lens is seeing a perfect image of the world around them. These are the most complex eyes we know of in all biological systems. No living organism has an eye this complex. The very first trilobites in the fossil record have that kind of complexity. At the outset, if you look at the fossil record of trilobites, they went extinct. And the eyed trilobites went extinct first. It's the blind trilobites that survived longer through the fossil record, in fact. The eyed ones, which probably were on the bottom, by the way, and the others were floaters, eyed forms were probably benthic forms, picked off and buried early in the flood because they were actually on the bottom of the ocean. The ones without eyes are floaters, and we know that. There are various reasons we can deduce that they float around on the surface. So here we have that kind of, I love trilobites because of that complexity. That's extraordinary. With all the complexity than the rest of the system, with a circulatory system, a nervous system, and so on and so forth, they have the most complicated optical systems in all of creation that we know of. On all these points, whatever there were, I don't know how many there were, 10 or so different points, major features of the fossil record are actually better explained by a crazy model of a flood than they are by the conventional model of evolution and great amounts of time and so on and so forth. So thank you very much.